Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRTLP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. I'm your host. Thank you for tuning in. Each June, the University of California at Davis chooses one student out of many thousands as its top graduating senior. This year, that student is Avantika Gokulnatha. Like the students who have received this award in previous years, her story is impressive on so many levels. Julia Ann Easley of UC Davis, writing this month about the award, said Avantika is receiving the honor for excellence in undergraduate studies, outstanding community service, and the promise of future scholarship and contributions to society. I find it all the more interesting when you see the kind of research she's interested in, which we'll get into in a minute. In fact, I have to say, I just feel better reading all this compared to a lot of the news we're hearing these days. And I'm happy to say she's our guest today on Davisville. Avantika, thank you for joining us and congratulations. Really, that's quite an achievement.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Several things about your work, your story, even how you managed to get everything done are interesting. But let's start with the degree that you've just earned in genetics and genomics. What does that field teach you?
Well, genetics and genomics are the kind of area of research into our genetic code, our DNA, and then how that plays out into creating us as organisms, our health outcomes, how we interact with the environment, and then investigating, going from a health problem, looking at, okay, how do we see, where does that come from? Starting from our actual DNA base pairs in our genome, but also looking at, oh, what are these other players that cause certain genes to be expressed in certain situations? So my degree kind of looked at this aspect both from the actual biology and molecular mechanisms, but also looking at what are the tools that we now have in terms of computational biology using artificial intelligence and coding to sort through vast amounts of genetic information to, elucidate these different important things that we can then use as potential therapies for the future.
Okay, so that's that. I was wondering what the value. I mean, I can see the value of that is just research for its own sake, understanding the human body and this human system better. But you want to be a physician scientist, as I understand. So, part of your interest, I think, right, is how you take this, what sounds like very complicated knowledge, very complicated understanding, and how that can be used to help people. Okay.
And looking at this field and here at UC Davis, there are so many instances where I've been able to get involved in this process of translation of taking these molecular mechanisms that we might study or all of these really complicated names of different proteins and genes and looking at how do these actually translate into creating real therapeutics and creating real outcomes for patients. So it's been a really wonderful place to get just beyond, being in the wet lab and doing all of these pipetting and molecular techniques and actually thinking about the broader impact that we can have on the world.
Now, eventually you want to go to medical school, right?
Correct.
Okay. So it'll take you a few years yet, I imagine, to get all these degrees accomplished, but I think I see the pattern emerging. You want to research, you also want to treat patients.
Correct.
So what drew you to this line of work?
Well, I mean, looking back, I think it's a lot of different moving factors kind of set things into place. I grew up here in the United States. I was born here in California, but my family immigrated from India. And so every year I would go back and visit my family and my grandparents once a year during the summer for around a month or two. And, if you go somewhere and you visit someone at that stage of life, like my grandparents who are 70 or 80 years old once a year, the process of aging and seeing age-related decline is very clear. And so from a young age, I would love to go and spend time with my grandparents, but I could see each year, they'd spend a little bit less time with me, or they would say, oh, I need to take a nap at a certain time of day that they didn't need to do a year before, or grandpa forgetting certain things about me that were unimaginable that he would forget earlier in his life. So that process of aging seemed very clear and ingrained in my mind as I was growing up. And as I got older, I started to question, why does this happen? Why does this need to happen? We all think about aging as kind of, a fundamental part of life, something that we don't question. We're all going to age. but there's a question of why. Why does this happen? What is driving it? And why does aging cause so much pain and in some cases suffering? You know, I could see how my grandparents were losing mobility, moving from like a walker, needing a cane, then a wheelchair, but the types of things that they weren't able to do anymore. So that kind of really drove that question of why do we age? And it wasn't until I got to UC Davis and I started learning more through my degree and being involved in labs such as the one I am at the UC Davis Medical Center that caused me to kind of consider this question from a different light. You know, it's not just that this is an inevitable phenomenon, but maybe if you can actually research the mechanisms that drive aging, we may not ever be able to make it preventable, but maybe we can understand how we can take away some of the pain and ease the process a little bit. So that kind of framework is what drew me to this point in my life. And beyond me, there is so much exciting research going on here in the United States in terms of aging biology. There are tons of companies in the San Francisco Bay Area that are trying to use this research to develop aging therapeutics that might kind of slow the process of aging a little bit. And so all of these different types of things really have cultivated an exciting path for me going forward and make me even more excited to continue pursuing this question of why do we age at all?
As I was listening to you right now, I was thinking of you. I mean, I don't know your family, of course, but I mean, I was picturing you as a child in India, and you're wanting to spend more time with your grandparents, and they can't. And so you think, all right, I'm going to go see what I can do to change that equation, not in time for them, but in time for other people. That's really at the heart of this, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially, you know, there is my experience with my own family. But before I got interested in the scientific basis of all of this, going to India, that's a different type of culture. I'm a lot more collectivist. And I saw how people in my grandparents' community took care of them like they were their own grandparents when I couldn't, and I was here in the United States. And that was always something that like caused me a little bit of pain because I felt like it was my role as a granddaughter to take care of my grandparents as they were aging. But just geographically, that was something I wasn't able to do. And so throughout my life, I've been inspired by the people in my grandparents' community that help them constantly every day, regardless of their connection with them. And coming to college, you know, I decided if I can't help my grandparents like this, I want to help someone else's grandparents, help out the people in my community. And here in the US, aging tends to be a bit more of a lonely, isolating experience than it does in other countries. And so I saw that very clearly when I joined a couple of organizations at UC Davis that volunteer in assisted living, help older adults learn technology. And so just going beyond my immediate family, I really saw the toll that aging can take, not just physically, but emotionally and psychologically. And just been a really heartwarming experience to be able to help in any capacity.
You're helping other people's grandparents and you know, ultimately yourself, you know, if you're you have a good long life. The UC Davis article talks about your work in this area. In fact, there's a wonderful photo of you with Jack Magruder, who's 96, and he lives in Fairfield. And in this photo, you're showing him how to use an app on an iPhone. You both look happy and fully engaged in that moment. Could you tell us what's happening in that scene?
Jack is someone that I met when I first came to UC Davis around 4 years ago. And not sure why, but we immediately hit it off and we've been in contact ever since. He gives me a call once every few days and we talk about, you know, the state of the world and what's going on and everything. And it's been really heartwarming to be able to help him meet the technology goals that, you know, he has. He formerly was an engineer. He ran his own company, and he's a man with so many ideas and so much excitement. But when you're a bit isolated from the rest of community and the world seems to be changing around you so much more rapidly than you're able to learn, it gets very frustrating. And so he has a lot of things that he wishes to learn on the iPhone, getting connected with people, getting on social media. And so every time I go over, we take steps to help him get connected in the ways that he wants to. Some time ago, we were able to look up some of his former business partners on Facebook and get them chatting with each other for the first time in 20 years. You know, you could use social media to track down people you have since lost contact with. So yeah, every time we go, we've done computer stuff, iPhone stuff, and just getting him to the place where he feels like he's able to engage with the world in the way he wants to.
You've done this with other people as well, right? Other seniors. Your underlying goal is to reduce isolation among seniors, right? And better connect them with the people they love or with society overall. And I do want to mention, just to get Jack Magruder's voice in here, in Julie Ann's story, a couple of things I thought were interesting about him. One, he's a veteran of World War II. Apparently, he must have been very young. If he's 96 now, to have been a veteran. But he worked as an electrical engineer and he owned a company that sold computer peripherals. Point is, he would have been around technology all his life. And so I think when you're making the point, this is clearly a very capable person, but the iPhone is still mystifying him a bit. Technology can overwhelm a lot of us. He also said, by the way, about you, he said, in addition to being smart, she's kind. She just helps you with a smile. So I guess I saw in that moment sort of your research. You're interested in helping aging be a more successful experience for people. But you're also just sort of going out there and just helping people who are already quite old and helping them connect. There was a group on campus you spent a couple of years leading, right?
Yeah, breaking barriers.
Breaking barriers. And this is what you would do, you and others. So you've written that you want to help transform aging from an inevitable decline to a manageable process. What do you hope to learn that can make aging more manageable?
I think that as of right now, we, like I was saying before, aging is kind of tends to be a mystifying thing because we say, oh, this is something that's inevitable, it's going to happen to everyone. So, what's the use in studying it? But, we do find that different people age in such different ways. That was particularly very evident to me when I would go to these assisted living facilities, help out all kinds of different groups of people who have their own experiences with aging. For example, with Jack, he's 96, he's still so mentally acute, he's extremely mobile. But there are other people I help that simply cannot comprehend anything I'm saying, people with dementia and things like that. And that diversity makes you question, well, why? Why do people age differently? Why do some people get dementia? Why do some people not? Why do some people have such immobility at the end of life while people like Jack can still walk around without a cane? And so that question of, what is the difference of aging really underlies, there's a need to study what the biological mechanisms are. And when I talk about maybe making a more manageable process, my goal is not maybe like others to kind of extend human life to as long as possible, but how do we perhaps maintain our health for longer fractions of our life so that even at age 80, we might still have the mobility to do the things that we love, like gardening, or to be able to go to church and engage with our community, rather than be wheelchair bound at 80 and not be able to do those things. So I think kind of the goal of this is how do we maintain the health that we have for longer fractions of our life until the last few years get very, very difficult.
And part of this discovery, I imagine you're hoping to find through a better understanding of genetics and genomics, different therapies, different treatments, things like that.
Yeah, correct. And there's a lot of current research going on in this exciting field. People have identified kind of 12 biological hallmarks of aging. So, 12 different kind of sectors of biology that we theorize to be very important in the aging process. And so, by targeting any of those 12 or, some combination of them together, potentially we have the chance to maybe make the aging process a little bit slower. Or for every two steps forward that the aging process takes us, maybe we can make it so that it's half as fast. So, like we cut the rate of aging in half. So, for example, I had the chance to intern at the NIH one summer while I was in college, National Institutes of Health in the Institute on Aging. And I was able to take part in a project where we looked at DNA damage. And so, as we age, our cells tend to get less efficient, all of our biological processes, and our DNA tends to have much more mutations and errors than what you would hope. And so, we theorize that that contributes to the aging process. But if we're able to make sure that our DNA repair mechanisms are stronger for larger portions of our life, we can mitigate those errors and thus slow the rate of aging theoretically. So avenues like this create all of these basic research ideas that we could potentially try to translate into therapies, but there's a lot of problems associated with, particularly in this field of how do you study whether a therapy is actually effective if, we have human life is an average of 75, 80 years old. So it's still an emerging field, but has potential.
Okay. To a quick station ID, this is Davisville on KDRT-LP 95.7 FM, kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan, and our guest today is Avantika Gokulnatha. She is the top graduating senior at University of California, Davis for 2025, and we're talking about her research and also just about the accomplishment. You've also done some research in the other area of life. I think it shows kind of the breadth of your interests. You've already managed a preliminary study in Sacramento into the correlation between children's mental health and managing diabetes. Could you tell us a little about that? What's the connection?
I've done a lot of research in the lab, but my passion and my area of interest is working with real people and seeing, what could be real effects on human life. And I had the great opportunity to work at a clinic over in Sacramento where I managed this study. Health is such a broad concept. I spend a lot of time looking at health from its very molecular mechanisms. What are these very small proteins that could cause these global diseases and such like that. But as we all know, health is much more beyond just our bodies. It includes our mental health. And also just even the translation of medication into real patients' life is a part of health. We cannot efficiently translate medical care to families and children and patients. Our goal is not really being accomplished. So over in Sacramento, I had the great opportunity to see when we're translating diabetes care, particularly for pediatric patients, what are these barriers that go beyond the doctor's purview to see how they translate. For example, how do parents speak to their children about their disease? How does that affect how a child views what it means to have type 2 diabetes? Does a child's own mental health and stress regarding regulating their blood sugar and regulating their A1C actually affect those true readings in months or weeks after?
Well, yeah, I was wondering, I mean, because diabetes can be, you have to manage your diet with it. And that can be difficult enough, I think, as an adult, and maybe even harder when you're a kid and, you're wanting to explore the world and do things and not be inhibited. I didn't know if that was part of the connection.
Yeah, exactly. And in the clinic, I was really able to see how in pediatric care, the patient is the patient, but it kind of extends to the whole family. As a physician and as medical professionals, you're helping out the whole family understand how to manage a child's illness. And there tends to be a lot of strife because, like you said, kids want to live what they might consider a normal life, do all the things that their friends want to do. Get coffee with their friends, or when you go to someone's birthday, you want to have a piece of their cake. But there tends to be a lot of issues that occur when it's difficult for a child of, say, 6 or 7 years old to understand why they can't live the same life that their friends are living. And different parents have different ways of approaching how to explain that to the child and different levels of maybe I would say strictness in regulating how their kid lives their life. That parent-child interplay again, relates to mental health, relates to family dynamics, and really at the end of it all relates to actual disease outcomes.
Yeah, and I imagine I mean, you're wanting to observe things so you get data, but at the end of that probably is the idea of trying to understand ways to improve it so the child has a better experience, can manage the disease, and also feel like they're living a pretty good life. We have, I don't know, 8, 10 minutes left or so. I wanted to ask, I got to ask about the Trump administration, because it's been cutting research grants, it's attacking Harvard and other U.S. universities, it's curtailing research at the Centers for Disease Control and so on. You obviously have thrived in this academic research system, in this case at UC Davis. What do you make of what Trump is doing?
I think I come at this from an interesting perspective because my parents had the opportunity to come to the United States to pursue graduate school and in case, graduate research. And so throughout my entire life, this has been something I've been very cognizant of because this is how my parents came to this country. This is their line of work and this is their career. And growing up, my mom would always tell me that, education is a way out. For them, it was a way to kind of move up, maybe economically, have more opportunities. And thus, it gave me and my sister opportunities. And it's really that research funding that allowed my parents to do this. And growing up in the Silicon Valley, I saw how much research, was ingrained in human life and how much impact it could make. And the US for a very long time has stood as a pivotal player in the global research landscape. We've made incredible innovations and investments in all areas of research. And at my time at the NIH, I was able to work in a government lab, government-funded lab, considered the best research institution perhaps on the planet. And I could truly see how that played together, with the US government's support and funding and a variety of researchers from all around the world really made the NIH a unique place where I could see that research was really at its finest state. And so it disappoints me to hear that the US government is cutting funding from all of these very critical and very wonderful establishments, because I think that the United States is very unique in its ability to draw, the greatest minds from all over the world and put in the funding to create innovations and outcomes that give back to the whole world. I think this is an interesting point in time to be at, but from my point of view, research has always been what I define to be American, because this is how I became an American. This is how I continue to contribute as an American. And I would love to go back and work at the NIH again and as a scientist and continue to give back. But without this funding, not sure what the possibilities are.
It's all still in flux. I mean, I suppose the administration would say, well, they're not against research, they're just against certain kinds of research, or that they think is wrong or something like that. Have you ever seen anything that struck you as wrong when you were at NIH?
I think it all comes down to the perspective that you're looking at it with. I know that there's a lot of naysayers who would say that aging research should not occur at all. We shouldn't be tampering with human lifespan. It's not a necessary avenue that we need to research. Aging is inevitable. We should leave it as it is. There are other areas that require much more investment of our time and money. So I think that at the end of it all, it just really comes down to values and how much value also people's values and perspectives play into scientific research. From my perspective, I thought that all of the research I've witnessed in all of my academic settings have been wonderful and truly dedicated to improving human life, human society. But I understand that that's not a perspective that everyone has, and I respect that. We live in a very diverse country and very diverse world, and that's how things tend to play out.
We have just a few minutes left. I do want to talk a little bit about kind of just how you did all this, because it's prodigious. I've talked with a couple of prior university medalists, and they had a couple of I guess maybe call them factors that helped them. And I'm wondering if you had things like this. For example, 10 years ago, I talked with one of your predecessors, and she said that while she was in college at UC Davis, sometimes her brother would cook meals for her, dinner, I think. Get free of her time, I suppose, and maybe give more time together. She also didn't keep a Facebook page in college. And at the time, that would have been a big deal. I mean, Facebook maybe not so much now, but it was then. And she scheduled in fun to make sure she had some. How about you? Do you have anything like that? Any factors like that that maybe sort of helped you get through some particularly tight moments in your schedule?
It's interesting because a lot of people ask me this question, but if you ask me to look back and reflect on college, I sometimes tend to forget all of the academic things I've done because I just feel like I spend most of my time hanging out with my friends, or one of my particular passions is art, and the UC Davis Craft Center has been a huge place where I've spent a lot of my time. And I think that balance is what really allows me to flourish, because it gives me that perspective of not only am I doing this, but why am I doing this? Who am I helping? And how do I critically engage with the work that I'm doing and really think about, well, is this necessary? What are the implications and things like that? That only comes through making friends with people who are very different than me, engaging in these communities that are outside of science, outside of research, outside of medicine. And nothing could have been done at all without the amazing mentors I've had. I think the single most important factor in my success has been that I've had so many wonderful professors, advisors, and friends at UC Davis that have made my success possible. Coming to college, I didn't know too much, but it was truly those advisors that led me down this path, told me about different opportunities, and encouraged my growth.
It sounds like they were doing their job, so to speak. And I gotta say, something you said just in passing struck me too. You mentioned the Art Center. Is it, don't want to put words in your mouth, but is it fair to say that something like the Art Center gave you sort of the mental space to solve the research problems that you're working on?
Definitely. And the Craft Center is, I've been a part of it for the past 4 years. And I think you really benefit from taking a step away from, research and academics and just growing as a person. I've just had so much fun there. And it's a place where I've learned how to fail. I constantly am failing at learning new skills. I've taken all kinds of different classes in glass blowing and ceramics and embroidery and all kinds of things. And that's where I've truly learned to fail because I'm often the worst person in the entire class. I took a 10-week pottery class and I still could not raise the walls of my mug by the end of it. And everyone else was making all kinds of things. But I think opportunities like this, really just ground me. And I'm like, well, I'm good at some things, but I'm not good at some things. And this is how to learn. This is how to learn when, no one can really teach you how to like throw a mug. Because at the end of the day, you're the one who has to do it. No matter how many times someone shows you have to figure it out yourself. So I think learning opportunities like this outside of taking exams, outside of taking finals, are really what, help me give me perspective and say, I can, there's all kinds of things going on in my life and I can get through them all because all I got to do is just try and learn.
I like the idea that you were the worst at that in your class, and yet here you are graduating the top of the senior class. Well, Avantika, thank you for talking with us. Actually, I should ask just real quickly, where are you headed next? I don't have hardly any time left, but where are you headed next from Davis?
Well, I recently got the Fulbright research grant to take a research position in Germany. So I'll be joining the Max Planck Institute for the Biology of Aging in September, and I'll spend around 10 months there.
Well, all the best to you everywhere you go. And thank you for talking with us today.
Yes, thank you guys so much for having me.
We've been talking with Avantika Golconatha, who is the top graduating senior at UC Davis this year. I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California. Thank you for listening.